Chapter 9. The Diane hadn't run off 2 degrees of longitude before the old pattern of seagoing life was as firmly settled as if it had never been interrupted. It's true that she ran them off slowly, rarely exceeding 5 knots and never logging more than 100 miles from noon to noon. This was not because she didn't try, not because she was too early for her rendezvous, far from it. That present, with the balmy air coming in 1 point abaft the beam, she had a magnificent display of canvas spread, with stunsails aloft and alow, royals and even skyscrapers, and a variety of rarely set objects on the stays. Yet the balmy air was so languid that she only just had steerage way. Jack Aubrey, having done all that could be done, paced fore and aft on the windward side of the quarterdeck, according to his habit before dinner, with his mind perfectly at ease on that point, if not on all others. The greater part of a lifetime afloat had convinced him that railing at the weather only spoilt one's appetite, which was always a pity, and which would be even more of a pity today, when he and Stephen, alone for once, were to eat some particularly fine fish bought from a proa that morning. "What is it that you wish me to see?" asked Stephen, coming up the companion ladder with his usual precautions, although there was scarcely any movement at all under his feet. "You can't see it from here because of the awning," said Jack, "but come with me along the weather gangway, and I'll show you something that perhaps you've never seen before." They went forward, and some of the hands in the waist nodded and smiled significantly. The doctor was going to be stunned, amazed, taken aback, all standing. "There," said Jack, pointing upwards, "abaft the topsail yard, right up against the trestle trees. Have you ever seen that before? The thing like a tablecloth pulled out at one corner?" asked Stephen, who could be sadly disappointing on occasion. "Well, it's a mizzen t'gallant staysail," said Jack, who'd expected little more. "You can tell your grandchildren you saw one." They walked back to the quarterdeck and resumed the pacing, Jack accommodating his long-legged stride to keep in step. "As I understand it," said Stephen, "we keep our appointment with Tom Pullings off the false Natunas and then drop Fox in Java to take an Indiaman home. But is it not a strangely roundabout way, as if one should go from Dublin to Cork by way of Athlone?" "Yes. His Excellency was good enough to point that out to me yesterday. Perhaps he showed you the same map. And I will make the same reply to you as I did to him. As the prevailing winds lie at this season, it is quicker to go back to Batavia by the false Natunas than by the Banker Strait. And then," lowering his voice, "which is more to my purpose, though not perhaps to his, there is our rendezvous." "Well, I'm content. There is, I presume, a convenient harbour in the false Natunas. And, by the way, why false? Are the inhabitants unusually treacherous?" "Oh, no. There's no harbour. That's only a sea-going expression, a hyperbole, as I believe you'd say. They're only a parcel of uninhabited rocks, like the dry salvages. It's understood that we cruise for a week in their latitude, or, in fact, a trifle south of it. Their longitude hasn't yet been fixed with any certainty. But, as you know, we can be reasonably sure of our latitude. And so we cruise along it, a glass at every masthead, and at night we may lie to with a lantern in each top. As for their being false..." The ship's bell stopped him in mid-stride, mid-sentence, and together they hurried below, their mouths watering steadily. "As for their being false," said Jack after a long and busy pause, "that arose when the Dutch were first making their conquests in these parts. The master of some ship bound for the real Natunas, but who was sadly out in his dead reckoning, raised them one foggy morning and cried, 'I've made the perfect landfall, ain't I the cheese?' The Dutch cheese, of course. But, however, when the mist lifted, they proved to be these mere goddamn barren rocks, looming large in the thick weather. So he put them down in his chart as the false Natunas. The South China Sea is full of places like that, imperfectly fixed, mistaken for one another. And vast areas outside the Indiaman's track aren't charted at all. Just hearsay of islands, reefs and shoals, picked up from proas or junks that can give only the vaguest of bearings for the places they're talking about. I'm sure you're right, yet it does seem strange to a landsman. These are populated waters. At this very moment, I can see... He was looking out of the stern window, his eyes narrowed against the brilliance of the day. Seven vessels. Two junks, one large proa, four small things with outriggers paddling fast. Whether fishermen or pirates on a modest scale, I cannot tell. It's just as occasion offers, I believe. In the South China Sea, by all accounts, the rule is to take anything you can overcome and avoid or trade with anything you can't. I'm afraid it was much the same with us until very recently. I have read strange accounts of Melsechlin the Wise, son of Erk, and he the kindest of men by land. But these are populated waters, as I was saying, and the Chinese who sailed them belong to a very highly civilized literate community, while the Malays are by no means ignorant of letters, as we know very well. Why, then, do we swim in this cloud of uncertainty? Because junks never draw more than a few feet of water, they're flat-bottomed, and proas even less, whereas a ship of the line, a 74, draws 22 or 23. Even our light draft aft is close on 14 foot, and with stores and all very much more. I'm never happy unless we have at least 4 fathoms under our keel, even in smooth weather. A shoal that a junk would scarcely notice, much less marked down, might rip our bottom out as easy as kiss my hand. These are the very words I shall use when I explain sailing in uncharted waters elsewhere after dinner, he said, with the significant look that often passed between them in this sounding box of a divided cabin. Stephen nodded, put his perfectly clean skeleton onto the dish in the middle, took another jar of a sea perch, looked at Jack's unseemly heap of bones, and observed, "You have to be a papist to eat fish, I find. Pray, tell me how you arrange private meetings at sea half the world apart." "They can't be at all precise at such a distance, but it is remarkable how often they answer. The usual thing is to give 3 or 4 cruising grounds, always, if possible, near some island where the message can be left after the agreed cruising time is over, and then, if circumstances call for it, we set a final rendezvous where one or the other can lie at anchor until a stated time. Ours is Sydney Cove. So, if we shouldn't meet this time, we have another chance. I'll not deceive you, Stephen. We do have another chance. In fact, we have 3 other chances. A week each side of the next 2 full moons, and then, of course, in New South Wales. What joy! I long to see the surprise in all our friends again. I long to tell Martin of my dear ape, my tarsier, that rarest of primates, my enormous beetle, whole unknown genera of orchids. What's amiss, brother? Have you all flogging to deal with? No. Just a disagreeable little matter to clear up. Tillick and Ahmed came in, the one bearing a roly-poly pudding and the other a sauceboat of custard. "Tillick," said Jack, "just jump round to the other side, will you? My compliments, and will His Excellency be at leisure for a few minutes in 30 minutes? Fox had never been liked in the Diane, but until Batavia he'd given little active offence, while his secretary Edwards was positively esteemed in a quiet way by both officers and foremast hands. But since the envoy's behaviour at Prabang, his ignoring of the people belonging to the ship that had taken him there, his total indifference to their pleasure at the signing of the treaty, his treatment of the Marine Guard, heirs and graces and all turn out to present arms every time the bugger puts his nose out of doors and not so much as a half bottle to drink the king's health even at the end, when him and his friends was as pissed as Davy's sow, and of the seamen who rowed him to and fro, this absence of liking had grown into strong reprobation. His suite, of course, and their servants had been unpopular from the beginning, But they were only passengers, and of passengers, landsmen at that, nothing could be expected. The present dislike of Fox was on another plane altogether. It was personal, not directed against a class. And it was so marked that a man far more insensitive than Fox must be conscious of it. "You may say what you please," said Jack, "but I've eaten roly-poly within the Arctic Circle, damned nearly within the Antarctic, and now under the equator, and I'm of opinion that it has not its equal. Except perhaps for a spotted dog. Ah, you have a point there, Stephen." They drank their coffee, and presently Jack said, "I hope to be back in 5 minutes." He was not back in 5 minutes, and Stephen sat there by the pot. How the coffee retained its heat in this climate, reflecting. He knew that last night some one of the mission had mounted to the dark quarterdeck, had approached Warren, the officer of the watch, just as the ship was wearing onto the larboard tack, had been intercepted by Reed, had cuffed the boy aside, and had told Warren that he should make more sail, that the captain would certainly wish it for the King's service, that this miserable pace was dawdling away precious time. But he hoped that Jack wouldn't take the matter up before Fox had to some extent recovered from his present state of overexcitement. A foolish hope, perhaps, since a thing of this kind had to be taken up at once to prevent any recurrence. The offence in naval eyes was very grave. And since there were no signs of Fox's restless enthusiasm declining at all. As he listened to the indistinct but certainly angry voices on the other side of the thin bulkhead, he reflected upon a whole variety of things, his mind relapsing into a contemplative after-dinner state in which it swam between dreaming and waking. And at one point he found himself recalling an eating-house by the Four Courts, an extraordinarily clear, detailed visual image of the place. He was sitting at the far end, and he saw a man open the door, look at the long, crowded room, it was term time, and after a moment's hesitation, walk in with exaggerated nonchalance, his hands in his pockets and his hat on his head, taking one of the few vacant places not far from Stephen. There was nothing in any way remarkable about him except that he was ill at ease. He felt conspicuous, regretted it, and made himself more conspicuous still by sprawling in his chair with his legs stretched out. But soon it became apparent that he was an ill-conditioned fellow as well. On being shown the bill of fare, he questioned the waiter about every other item. Was the mutton well hung? Had the parsnips no wood in their middle? Was it bullocks, beef or cows? And eventually he called for Colcannon, a cut off the sirloin, and half a pint of sherry. By this time he was aware that he was an object of dislike, and he ate his meal with deliberate coarseness, hunched there with his elbows on the table, fairly exuding hostility and defiance. "If this is my inner man providing me with an analogy," he said, his mind moving into the present, "I cannot congratulate him at all. He has left out the essential factor of triumph and intense excitement. The only valid aspect is the man suspecting that he's unpopular and then going to great pains to make certain he's loathed." Stephen had never liked or wholly trusted Fox, but until the actual signature of the treaty they'd got along smoothly enough. During the negotiations, in which Stephen had enabled the envoy to outflank Duplessis again and again, and in which, as Fox knew very well, he had acquired the support of a majority in the council, without which the execution of Abdul would have had no diplomatic effect, they'd worked well together, and he'd been touchingly grateful for Stephen's help in the matter of Ledward and Ray. But a kind of lasting drunkenness or exaltation had come upon him at the ceremony of signature, the consummation of their voyage, and since that moment he'd treated Stephen very shabbily indeed. It was not only his inattention to his guest at that discreditable meal. It was a quantity of minor slights and an insistence upon his sole, unaided personal success. And although even in the most unreserved flow of indiscretion during that interminable dinner, Fox hadn't betrayed Stephen's real function, it was no very ungenerous reflection to suppose that this was because he meant to arrogate all the merit to himself. What would Raffles make of that? What would Raffles make of the present Fox? What would Blaine have to say to him? It was altogether a very strange state of affairs. Here was a man of real abilities, one who had despised the old buggers and apologised for them, but who was now revelling in their company and their by no means delicate flattery. It was known that the governorship of Ben Coolan would soon be vacant, and they all asserted that Fox must be the obvious choice. This pleased him, but it was a knighthood that Fox really longed for. He was convinced, or very nearly convinced, that his treaty would earn him one, and nothing could exceed his desire to get back to England for it as soon as conceivably possible. He even contemplated the extremely arduous overland journey. There is some flaw there, some radical disturbance, said Stephen. Was it always present? Should I have detected it? What is the prognosis? He shook his head. I wish I could consult Dr. Willis, he said aloud. Who's Dr. Willis? Asked Jack, opening the door. He was a man of great experience in disorders of the mind. He looked after the king in his first illness. He was kind to me when I was young, and if he were alive now, I should importune him with my questions. May I ask any of you, or would that be untimely, indiscreet, improper? He could see from Jack's face that the visit hadn't been pleasant, but he didn't think that Fox, even with all his present glory and his elevated state of mind, was of such moral weight as to cause Jack Aubrey much uneasiness. And he wasn't surprised at the reply, Oh, it was a disagreeable little interview. I thought it might be. But at least I believe the matter's dealt with. There'll be no repetition. Later, speaking in a disconnected, dissatisfied voice, he said, Why, I cannot tell, but this has been preparing ever since we left Pula Prabang. Still, I had hoped to get through the next few days without a collision. It's so unpleasant to have bad blood aboard. I shall be heartily glad to be shot of them. Nutmeg of consolation, maybe, rose of delight, perhaps, but flower of courtesy, the scrub. Apart from anything else, I can't play easy with ill will just at hand. We've had no music since we sailed. Yet even with this wind, we should reach our cruising ground by something like noon tomorrow, and then it's only a week of going to and fro if Tom isn't already there or has left no message. But then the couple of days run to Batavia. Perhaps there'll be news from home waiting for us there. Lord, how I should love to know how things are going. Oh, so should I, cried Stephen. Though it's not yet possible there should be word of Diana and our daughter. Sometimes when I think of that little soul, I grow quite lachrymose. A few months of roaring and bawling and swaddling clothes will soon cure you of that. You have to be a woman to bear babies. So I've always understood, said Stephen. Oh, very well, Dr. Humorous Droll. But there's also that damned uneasy talk about banks breaking that I should like to see denied. And later still, when he was floating in the warm South China Sea by Stephen's skiff, his hair spreading like a mat of yellow seaweed, he said, I shall ask them to dinner for the day after tomorrow in return for that remarkable feast. I don't wish to look pitiful, but I know what's due to his office. Jack, I beg you will watch your step, however. Fox is an extraordinarily revengeful man and a lawyer. And if he can carry home any substantial grievance, it may do you harm in spite of your position. For a short while, he is likely to have the ear of those in power. Oh, I shall not commit myself, said Jack. I've seen too many post-captains, good seamen too, denied another ship for flying out under provocation. The breeze had dropped entirely, as it often did for an hour before sunset, and the ship lay motionless. But the sun wasn't far from the rim of the sea. The breeze would return when it dipped. And Jack, calling upon Stephen to lay over there, heaved himself into the little boat, gliding his 17-stone over the gunwale so that it remained just free of the surface. "I believe you once said you were taught Greek when you were a little boy," said Stephen as he paddled gently towards the frigate. "To be sure, I was taught it," said Jack, laughing, "or rather I was attempted to be taught it, and with many a thump. But I can't say I ever learnt it, not beyond Zeta at all events. Well, I am no Grecian either, but I did get as far as Upsilon. And there I met with the word hybris, which some writers use for insolent pride of strength or achievement, open unguarded triumph and exultation. Nothing more unlucky, nor in a way more impious, which is perhaps close kin. Herod was probably guilty of hybris before being eaten by worms. My old nurse, back astern there, t'other, or look alive. Jack's old nurse had had a capital remedy for worms, or rather against worms, but it was lost in the dismal collision, the rescuing of Maturin from the bottom of the boat, the recovery of his skulls. Jack, when he at last got there, was received at the gangway by Killick, screened by Richardson, Elliot, the young gentleman and two quartermasters, and wrapped in a large towel. All hands knew perfectly well how the wind was blowing, and though utterly indifferent to his state themselves, they didn't wish Fox and his old buggers to see their captain mother naked. After quarters that evening, when, for the first time since the Sultan's visit, the Diane's guns spoke out in earnest, achieving their three broadsides in a fairly creditable 4 minutes and 23 seconds, and after the bulkheads had been replaced, Jack said to his steward, "Killick, I'm asking His Excellency in the suite to dinner, not tomorrow, because I mean to spread out, but the day after. 5 gentlemen, Mr. Fielding, the doctor, and myself. You'd better get the sherry and claret over the side, towing deep right early, and let's have a fine blaze of silver. And I should like a word with my cook and Jemmy Ducks." By logic clear to all seafaring men, turtles came under the heading of poultry, as far as their care and well-being were concerned. And Jemmy Ducks said that he had never seen a brisker nor so likely a creature than the larger of the two in his charge. The other seemed timid, rather bashful-like. As for the little Java geese, he had 4 prime birds fairly yearning for the spit, and 4 birds would be plenty for 8 gents with quite enough over for manners. The captain's cook, a one-legged black man from Jamaica, said with a flashing smile that if there was one thing he really could send up the table fit for King George himself, it was a goose. And turtles, of course, came as natural to him as kiss my hand, he having been weaned on calipash and calipee. That was very satisfactory, said Jack. I should have been sorry to keep the matter hanging for any length of time. And having written the invitation and sent it off, he said, "Since we can't have our music, what do you say to a hand of piquet? It's years since we played." "I should be very happy." Happy in a sense, since he always invariably, with the utmost regularity, skinned Jack Aubrey, as he skinned most others at this game. And although the money was now of no significance, it was still a pleasure to see his point of 5 outdo Jack's by a single pip, his terse major triumph over a terse minor, and Jack's eagerly announced septiem beaten down by the almost unheard of huitiem. Yet, in another sense, unhappy. uneasy at the sight of all this luck slipping away in trivialities, for although there was skill in the game for sure, this kind of success was all luck. And if a man had only a given amount for his whole share, it was a shame to fritter away so much as a pugil. "What's a pugil?" asked Jack, to whom he had made this observation. "It is a physical term, a fair and just return for all your poops and garstrakes, and it means as much as you can pick up between your thumb and first two fingers. Dried herbs and the like. Jesuit's bark, for example." "I've always heard that a Jesuit's bark is worse than his bite," said Jack, his blue eyes, slits of mirth in his fine red face. "Go in," he called. It was Edwards, extremely unhappy. "Good evening, gentlemen," he said. And then, addressing Jack, "His Excellency's compliments, sir, and would it be possible to diminish the noise on the forecastle? He finds it breaks in upon his work." "Does he indeed?" said Jack, cocking his head forward. "I'm sorry to hear that." This was the last dog watch, and the hands had been turned up to dance and sing. Not that they needed any encouragement, not that they wouldn't have danced and sung without the pipe, but the pipe made the whole thing legal, not to be checked for any ordinary reason. "That must be Simmons' Tromba Marina," he said, catching the distinctive note, a note that could scarcely be missed. An immensely loud, deep, brassy hoot marking the end of a measure in the dance, and followed by a confused cheering and two more hoots. "Have you ever seen a Tromba Marina, Mr. Edwards?" he asked, to ease the young man's woe. "Never, sir." "It's a very singular instrument, a kind of prism of three thin planks, about a fathom long, with a string stretched over a curious bridge. It's played with a bow, though you'd never think so from the sound. If you'd like to see one, go along forward with the midshipman. A carpenter's mate knocked it together the other day." He rang his bell, and to Seymour he said, "My compliments to Mr. Fielding, and the merriment on the forecastle is to diminish by half." "I would have sworn that was an answer to my note," he said, returning to his disastrous game. In fact, the answer didn't appear until well on in the next forenoon watch, when he came from the masthead in a long, controlled glide down the main-topgallant backstay. The Diane had been on a cruising ground for some hours now, and each mast had its lookout. In this clear weather, they could survey 700 square miles of sea, but so far they'd seen nothing at all. Not so much as a proel or a drifting palm trunk. A pale, cobalt dome of sky darkening imperceptibly as it came down to the sharp horizon and the true azure of the great disk of ocean. Two pure, ideal forms, and the ship between them, minute, real, and incongruous. "Sir, there's a note for you in your cabin, if you please," said Fleming. "Thank you, Mr. Fleming," said Jack. "Pray let me have it together with my sextant." While they were coming, he looked at the logboard. Between 4 and 5 knots, with this rather stronger breeze, just 1.3. "Very little leeway, Mr. Warren," he observed. "Almost none at all, sir," said the master. "I paid particular attention each time the log was heaved." The note and the sextant came. He slipped the paper into his pocket, stepped over to the starboard hanses, and brought the sun down to the horizon. The corrections, for the time short of noon, were clear in his mind. He applied them to his reading and nodded. The Diane was certainly on her true parallel. He found Stephen in the cabin, working over a musical score by the strong light of the stern window. "We're on our true parallel," he said, and opened the note. "Well, I'm forever damned alive," he said in quite a surprised tone of voice, and passed the unfolded sheet. "Mr. Fox presents his compliments to Captain Aubrey, whose invitation to dinner on Wednesday he has received, but which pressure of work prevents him and his suite from accepting. Well, said Stephen, I hadn't thought a man of his education could be so gross. Tell me, brother, were you very severe? Not at all. The only time I spoke a little sharp was when he asked me whether I knew I was addressing His Majesty's direct representative, and I told him that though he might represent the king by land, I represented him by sea, that under God I was sole captain aboard. A pause. Killick, called Jack. Killick there! Now what? Cried Killick with real indignation. He was wearing a frock and gloves that shed powdered chalk at every movement. And there was a long pause before he added the necessary sir. Killick has been polishing the silver, observed Stephen. And only half done, and my mate's always needing an eye on them. Heavy-handed hose liable to scratch it something cruel. Killick took a passionate delight in silver, and for this dinner he had brought out the rarely used best service, much tarnished in spite of its green baize. "Pass the word for Mr. Fielding," said Jack, and to his first lieutenant, "Mr. Fielding, pray sit down. I have a damned awkward request to make of you in the gunroom. The position is this. I had invited the envoy and his colleagues to dine with me tomorrow. Foolishly, I took their consent for granted. And here's poor Killick in a cloud of powdered chalk while my cook is working double tides at two or even three courses and God knows how many removes. But this morning, I find that I had counted my geese without laying their eggs, that I had killed my geese. That is to say, pressure of work prevents Mr. Fox and his people from dining with me tomorrow. So, what I should like to do, with your permission, is to invade the gunroom and feast among friends. It's a damned left-handed kind of an invitation, yet left-handed it might have been, but it was an unusually happy and successful one. The gunroom table blazed from a great gilt tureen at its foot to the golden mizzenmast in the middle, and then to another gilt tureen at its head, and they, standing in a springtide of silver, exactly squared and set so thick that there was scarcely room for bread between. No direct sun reached it, but in the diffused light the general effect was extraordinarily rich. And the hands brought aft on various pretexts felt that he did their ship the utmost credit. The splendour had the curious effect of doing away with the stiffness and solemnity that usually and perhaps necessarily attended the captain's ordinary visits to the gunroom. From the beginning it was clear that this was not going to be one of those many, many yes-sir, no-sir dinners through which Jack Aubrey had sat since his very first command, labouring in an occasionally successful attempt at making official entertainment somewhat less forbidding. It hadn't needed as much as a single bottle of wine to set the table in a pleasant hum of conversation, though the stream that flowed throughout the meal certainly helped. Nothing particularly brilliant was said, but all the officers sitting there were pleased with their company, pleased with their fare, and pleased with the glory. Another point was the servants. Every man had one behind his chair, sometimes a marine, sometimes a ship's boy, and although they were well turned out, clean and attentive, they were not highly trained. Even the comparatively rigid marines took a certain part in the feast, much more than usual on this glittering occasion, which pleased them even more than the guests. And the attendants' smiles, nods, becks, for there was no pretense of not listening to what was said at table, and cheerful faces added to the general gaiety. At one point they added too much. Welby, the marine officer, was almost as inept a teller of anecdotes or jokes as Captain Aubrey, but he did have one story in which he could scarcely go wrong. It was true, it was decent, he'd told it many, many times, and it had no pitfalls. Now, in very fine form after his second helping of goose and his sixth glass of wine, he launched upon it. He caught Jack's eye during a momentary lull in the conversation, smiled at him and said, "A curious thing happened to me, sir, when I was acting as recruiting officer in the year 8. A young fellow, a fine, upstanding young fellow, though rather ragged, came to the rendezvous. I was sitting there at a table with the clerk and my sergeant behind me, and I said to him, 'You look as if you might suit us. Where do you come from?' 'Where?' says he. 'Yes, where?' says I. And the sergeant says rather louder, 'The captain asks where you come from. What is your parish?' 'Where?' says he. 'No,' says I louder still. 'Where was you born?' 'Where?' says he in a shout, looking dogged. And the sergeant was going to learn him his duty when the clerk whispered, 'I believe, sir, he means Ware, the town of Ware in Hertfordshire.'" At this, Macmillan's servant, a ship's boy more used to the midshipman's berth than the gun room, burst into a half-strangled hoot of laughter, a hideous adolescent crowing that set off two other boys. They couldn't look at one another without starting again, and they were obliged to be put out. They missed the rest of Welby's tale, a fictitious addition that had just occurred to him in which the recruit's name was Watt. "A glass of wine with you, Mr. Welby," said Jack, when at last the laughter had died away. "Yes, Mr. Harper, what is it?"
"Mr. Richardson's compliments on duty, sir, and there's land bearing north nor east about 5 leagues."
The news of land spread through the ship, and after dinner the mission came on deck to gaze at the horizon on the larboard bow, where the false Natunas, already clear from the tops, might soon be seen by those that didn't choose to climb. Stephen met Loder, the least objectionable of the old buggers, on the companion ladder.
"You should have had a very cheerful time in the gunroom," said Loder.
"'Twas most agreeable," said Stephen. "Good company, a great deal of mirth, and the best dinner I remember ever to have eaten at sea. Such a turtle, such Java geese."
"Ah,"
said Loder, meaning by this that he regretted the turtle and the geese, that he thought Fox's refusal for his colleagues an abuse of authority, and that he, for one, dissociated himself from the barbarous incivility. A considerable burden for a single "ah," but one that it bore easily. Stephen had, in fact, already noticed a decline in the sweet's excitement, something of a return to everyday sobriety, though Fox's exultation was still at the same high and surely very wearing pitch.
"May I consult you, Doctor, when you have a spare moment?"
asked Loder in a discreet voice.
"I don't like to speak to the ship's young man."
"Certainly. Come to the dispensary tomorrow at noon," said Stephen. And he went on to meet Macmillan himself. They made their round together. The usual port diseases had made their appearance. And when they, for want of an intelligent, reliable loblolly boy, had rolled their own pills, prepared their own draughts, and triturated their own quicksilver in hogslard for blue ointment, Stephen said to Macmillan, "Among your books, do you have Willis on mental derangement or any of the other authorities?"
No, sir, I'm sorry to say I've not. All I have in that line is an abstract of Cullen. Shall I fetch it?"
"If you'd be so very kind." He returned to his cabin carrying the book by way of the quarterdeck, and there he saw Fox at the Lee Hanses staring intently at the Natunas. The false Natunas. All the species and degrees of madness which are hereditary, or that grow up with people from their early youth, are out of the power of physic, and so, for the most part, are all maniacal cases of more than 1 year standing, from whatever source they may arise. He read, nodded, and turned the page. Another remarkable circumstance is that immoderate joy as effectually disorders the mind as anxiety and grief, for it was observable in the famous South Sea year, when so many immense fortunes were suddenly gained and as suddenly lost, that more people lost their wits from the prodigious flow of unexpected riches than from the entire loss of their whole substance.
"That is something to the point," he said, "but what I really want is a case of the sudden onset of folie de grandeur."
He glanced at the measures recommended. Diet low but not too low. Bleeding, of course. Cupping, saline purgatives, emetics, camphorated vinegar, the straight waistcoat, blistering head, chalybeate waters, the cold bath. And closed the book. Presently, heavy with turtle soup, goose and a number of side dishes, he closed his eyes as well. The Diane stood off and on all night, just south of the False Natunas, and quite early in the morning Captain Aubrey stood tall and shadowy by Stephen's cot.
"Are you awake?" he asked in a soft voice.
"I am not," said Stephen.
"We're going ashore in the new pinnace, and I thought you might like to come. There may be a whole colony of nondescript boobies."
"So there may. How truly kind. I shall be with you in a minute."
So he was, unwashed, unshaved, tucking his nightshirt into his breeches as he tiptoed across the twilit deck, now being flogged dry after a thorough swabbing. They helped him down into the boat.
"Why, it has masts!"
he exclaimed as he sat in the stern sheets.
"I hadn't noticed before."
The faces of the boat's crew lost all expression. They gazed into vacancy.
"We take them down when she's hoisted in, you know," said Jack. "It makes stowing one inside the other so much easier."
And turning to the coxswain's seat, he asked, "How does she handle Bondon?"
"Fine and stiff, sir," answers, "very quick. So far, I should say she's a rare pretty job for a country boat."
She was pretty. Fine-grained teak, carvel built, as smooth as a dolphin's skin. But Stephen's eyes were fixed on the island ahead, as black and jagged a mass of tumbled rock as could be desired and surely uninhabited, but by no means as barren as he had supposed. There were coconut palms growing at odd angles here and there, with a curious grey vegetation between the naked boulders. At midday it might look as repulsive as a slag heap, but now, in the perfect clarity of growing daybreak, it had a severe beauty of its own. A moderate surf, white against the black, and the whole bathed in an indescribably soft and gentle light. Furthermore, so exceptional a mass of rock, largely earthless, baked by a tropical sun and soaked by tropical rains, was likely to have an exceptional flora and fauna.
"Bear a hand with the lead,"
said Jack, and sounding as they went, they coasted along to a little bay, dropped a grapnel, and pulled in to the low-tide shore, one part white where the currents laid down coral sand, the other the unredeemed, dull black of the mother rock. Two hands leapt out with a gangplank. Jack and Stephen went ashore, followed by Seymour and Reed, Bondon, and a young foretopman called Fazakerly. They carried a compass, tools, a bottle, and a pot of paint. And as they walked up the damp sand to the tide mark, the sun rose behind them. They turned to look. Pure sea, pure sky, and the sun, at first an orange arc in the faint haze, then a half disk still to be borne with narrowed eyes, and at last a blinding sphere heaving clear from the horizon entirely and providing them with long, dark shadows. Jack took the bearings, stared inland for some while, and then, nodding towards a crag, he said, "I'm afraid there's no paint upon it, but that's probably the most conspicuous rock, don't you agree, Doctor?"
"Certainly it stands well above its fellows, but why should there be any paint upon it at all?"
It was agreed that the first to come should leave his message 22 yards north of a conspicuous rock marked with white.
22 yards, for our love? It's the length of a cricket pitch.
They left their message in its bottle, they left their mark, and they sailed back to the ship, carrying a collection of plants and insects that would have been very much larger if at last the captain hadn't cried, "Come, we shall miss our tide, there's not a moment to lose." All these things were handed up the side, and some of them, in pillboxes, accompanied Stephen to breakfast. "It would have been worth getting up before dawn, merely for the splendid appetite it engenders," he said. "But when to the appetite you add anomalous annelids and some of these plants, when I finish my kedgeree, I will show you the isopod crustaceans I found under a fallen branch. They're almost certainly close kin to our own wood lice, but with some most unusual adaptations to this climate. How Martin will love to see them!" "I hope he will before long. We're on our true parallel, and as we sail to and fro upon it, we may meet with them at any time. Today we shall stand to the east, perhaps lying to at night, and tomorrow to the westward, and so on for a whole week." "You've been out in the new pinnace, I hear," said Loder, who had kept his appointment in the dispensary to the minute, but who now seemed unwilling to state his symptoms. "How does she handle?" "Very well, I believe. You're a sailor, sir?" "I've always loved it. We had a yacht in England, and I have a little yawl here, a country boat like yours, but clinker-built. I sailed her right round Java last year with a couple of hands. She's half-decked. Pray, take off your clothes and lie on this couch or padded locker," said Stephen. And some time later, he said as he washed his hands, "I'm afraid you are right in your surmise, Mr. Loder, but we've caught it early, and this ointment, these pills, will probably check it in no great length of time. You must apply the one and swallow the others with exact regularity, however. The Prebang infection is particularly virulent. Come tomorrow at the same time, and I'll see how you're getting on. You will strictly observe your diet, of course. No wine or spirits, very little meat." "Of course. Thank you very much indeed, Doctor. I'm extremely obliged to you." Loder dressed, put the remedies in his pocket, and went on, "Extremely obliged both for these and your great care, and for not being lectured. There's no fool like an old fool, as I know very well, but the old fool don't like being told of it." He paused, and then said rather awkwardly, "By the way, I suppose you cannot tell me when we shall be back in Batavia. I should love to see how my English lettuces are coming along, and of course Fox is in a tearing hurry. As I understand it, we are to sail up and down for a while in the hope of meeting another ship, and then sheer off for Java or possibly New South Wales. But I may well be mistaken. If Mr. Fox were to ask Captain Aubrey, the fount of orders, directions, and all proper information, I dare say he would be told with greater certainty." But Fox didn't ask Aubrey. They moved their hats to one another, and sometimes exchanged a "good morning, sir," when they took their exercise on the quarter-deck, the captain on his holy weather side, the envoy and his suite on the other. But it went no further, and what communication existed was carried on in an oblique, rather furtive way, by means of Loder's conversations with Maturin and Edwards's with the gunroom, his friendship with the officers being unaffected. The ship sailed east, with a steady breeze on her larboard beam, still in this fine, clear weather, and in a springing, cheerful atmosphere of hope. The hope wasn't fulfilled that day, but it was with no real disappointment that she wore round on the starboard tack a little after sunset and proceeded slowly westwards under close-reefed topsails and a blaze of lanterns. Westward to the night of Thursday, and turn again, the lookouts eagerly making the whole deliberate sweep of the horizon from their mastheads. They could see 15 miles of ocean in every direction before the curve of the earth carried it below their range, but even then a ship sailing on the hidden surface as far as 15 miles beyond would still show the far white fleck of her t'gallant sails to the watchful eye. At noon, The officers on deck took the altitude of the sun once more. Their course was exactly true. Far below, Stephen, having finished with his patient and having prepared the physic while the patient babbled on, nervousness made Loder talkative, said, "In answer to your first question, yes, your informant was perfectly in the right of it. Captain Aubrey is member for Millport, a family borough. He's a wealthy man with estates in Hampshire and Somerset, and he's very well with the ministry. And in answer to your second, or the implication of your second, no, I will not act as a go-between." He said this rather loud, to be heard through the din of the hands being fed. It was wonderful how a mere 200 men could fill the entire ship with noise. But once each mess had been provided with Thursday's salt pork, the sound died away. And by the time Stephen came on deck to ask for another windsail in the sick bay, there was quietness enough for him to hear the run of the water along the ship's side, the familiar creak of rigging, the sound of blocks, and the general continuo of the wind blowing across 1,000 cords, lines, and ropes of varying tautness. Jack and Fielding were looking down into the new pinnace, whose foremast was having its step moved 4 inches forward. But after a few minutes' earnest conversation, Jack turned and, seeing him, called out, "There you are, Doctor. Should you like to go into the top and view the false Natunas again?" "Few things would give me greater pleasure," said Stephen, lying in his heart. He had never overcome his dread of height, his distrust of these insecure swaying rope ladders, ill-adapted for their purpose, more suitable for apes than rational beings. Yet as he climbed, he reflected that the distinction was unsound. Mwong was an ape. Mwong, though slow-witted at times and occasionally stubborn, was a rational being. "There," said Jack, passing his telescope. "I can make out our white streak where young Booby spilt the paint pot. But I'm afraid the answering flag ain't there. They haven't passed by yet." He said the same on Friday. Just such a day, just such a course, still with lively expectations aboard, hope not disappointed but only deferred. And again Stephen, before beginning his horrifyingly inept descent, remarked upon the total absence of ships, vessels, small craft, an ocean strangely deserted even by the seabirds themselves. It was perhaps unreasonable to hope for the Philippine pelican, yet this is supposed to be an archipelago. It was during these days that Stephen, who usually took up his after-dinner station by the taffrail, sometimes gazing at the wake, sometimes gazing forward, noticed signs not exactly of disaffection among the envoy's suite, but rather of an increasing lack of the first eager enthusiasm and deference, even toadyism. Fox seemed unaware of it, however, and his own excitement was undiminished, his voice loud and confident, loud and high-pitched, his eyes unusually bright, his step elastic. On Saturday he met Stephen walking along the half-deck and cried, "Why, Maturin, how do you do? It's a great while since we exchanged more than a good day. Will you indulge me in a game of backgammon?" Fox played with great want of attention, and having quite unnecessarily lost the second game, a downright backgammon with one on the bar and one in Stephen's home table, he said, "As you may imagine, I'm extremely eager that our triumph should be known in England as soon as possible, because," he had emphasised the hour, but with Stephen's cool, thoroughly informed eye upon him, he felt unable to produce any of the high political and strategic reasons he'd mentioned to Loder. And after a pause for coughing and blowing his nose, he went on, "So, naturally, I should very much like to know what Captain Aubrey has in mind, whether he still intends to pursue the course we spoke of earlier, or whether this more or less mythical ship I hear of has suddenly assumed great importance." "I'm sure he would tell you, were you to ask him." "Perhaps so, but I don't choose to risk a snub. He spoke to me in a most intemperate manner the other day,
enlarging upon the powers of the captain of a man-of-war, his unaccountability to anybody's own superiors in the service, and his complete autonomy afloat. An absolute monarch. He spoke with a masterful, domineering authority and dislike that shocked me extremely. And this wasn't the first example of ill will by any means. An ill will that I find absolutely incomprehensible. Gratuitous and incomprehensible. I don't believe it exists. A brief, strongly expressed vexation about the incident some nights ago, certainly, since for a sea officer it was a most heinous offence. But as to any settled ill will, no, not at all. Then why did he not have the ship dressed with flags everywhere and the sailors standing on the yards and cheering when I embarked with the treaty? I pass over many other slights, but an insult so deliberate as that could only be the effect of deep ill will. No, my dear sir, said Stephen, smiling. There, you must allow me to correct a misapprehension. Manning the ship occurs when a member of the royal family visits her, sometimes when two consorts meet or part, and above all in honour of an officer who has won a famous victory. Captain Brooke of the Shannon was so honoured in my sight. But the victory has to be won in battle, my dear sir, not at the council table. It must be a military, not a diplomatic victory. For a moment, Fox was staggered. But then his face resumed its look of complete, knowing assurance. He nodded and said, "You are obliged to support your friend, of course. And, of course, our motives are quite clear. There's no more to be said." He stood up and bowed. Stephen's intense irritation lasted all the time he was climbing into the main top, and this so took away from his dread and his habitual caution that Jack said, "What a fellow you are, Stephen. When you choose, you can go aloft like..." He was about to say a human being, but changed this before it quite left his gullet to like an able seaman. A league away to the north, over a sea that seemed as devoid of malice as it was of ships, birds, cetaceans, reptiles, or even driftwood, a sea of the second day of creation, rode the white-fringed false Natunas, their generous streak of paint as certain in the glass as the absence of any kind of flag. "This is not unlike polishing Cape Sissier on the Toulon blockade," said Jack, closing his telescope. "Day after day we saw that goddamn headland, always looking much the same. We used to stand in..." "But of course you remember it perfectly well. You were there." "Yes, Mr. Fielding." "I beg pardon, sir," said his first lieutenant, "but I quite forgot to ask you whether we were rigging church tomorrow. The choir would like to know what hymns to prepare." "Well, as for that," said Captain Aubrey with a resentful look at the false Natunas, "I think the articles would come better before the salute. You've not forgotten it's coronation day, I'm sure." "Oh, no, sir, I was having a word with Mr. White just now. Should you like the board put out, sir?" "I know them pretty well by heart, but even so it'd be as well to have the board. Two precautions are better than one." It was before this folding, double-leafed object, like a logboard, but with a large printed text of the Articles of War pasted on the wood and varnished, that Captain Aubrey took up his stand at a little after six bells in the forenoon watch on Sunday. He had already inspected his ship, and now its well-washed, shaved, clean-shirted people were ranged before him in attentive groups, rather than regular lines. Though the mission, the officers and young gentlemen, gave the assembly a more formal appearance, and the marines provided their usual geometrical red-coated perfection. The articles didn't possess the terrible force of some parts of the Old Testament, but Captain Aubrey had a deep voice with immense reserves of power, and as he ran through the catalogue of naval crimes, it took on a fine comminatory ring that pleased the hands almost as much as Jeremiah or the Great Anathema.
It seemed to Stephen, who attended this ceremony as he did not that of the Anglican rite, that Jack slightly emphasised Article 23. If any person in the fleet shall quarrel or fight with any other person in the fleet, or use reproachful or provoking speeches or gestures tending to make any quarrel or disturbance, he shall, on being convicted thereon, suffer such punishment as the offence shall deserve and a court-martial shall impose. And 26. Care shall be taken in the conducting and steering of any of His Majesty's ships, that through wilfulness, negligence, or other defaults, no ships be stranded, or run upon any rocks or sands, or split or hazarded, upon pain that such as shall be found guilty therein be punished by death. He didn't stress the notorious 29, which laid down that any man guilty of buggery or sodomy with man or beast should also be punished with death, but a good many of the foremast hands, particularly those who had rowed Fox to and fro across that blazing anchorage without so much as a good day or a thank you, did so for him, with coughs and pointed looks, and even, far forward, a discreet ha-ha. Jack clapped the boards to, and called out in an equally official voice, "All hands face starboard! Carry on, Mr. White!" Fox and his suite sat there, looking uncertain. But as the royal salute boomed on and on in its deliberate splendour, the loyal smoke bank rolling away to leeward, the envoy's face cleared, and after the last gun he stood up, bowing right and left, and said to Fielding, "I thank you for a very handsome compliment, sir." "Oh, no, sir," said Fielding. "I must beg your pardon, but no thanks are due. It was in no way personal. All ships of the Royal Navy fire a royal salute on Coronation Day." Somebody laughed. And Fox, with a furious look, walked rapidly to the companion ladder. The laughter had come from the waist or the gangway. No one on the quarter-deck took the least notice of the painful little incident, and while the Diane was returning to her usual occupation, Jack took a few turns fore and aft, fanning himself with his best gold-laced hat. He said to Stephen, "Somewhere in these waters Tom will have done the same. How I hope they heard us. That would bring them tearing down indeed, clapping on like smoke and oakum." They reached the barricade, and Jack, looking forward, noticed a ship's boy seated on the forgier bits rising and bowing graciously right and left. "Mr. Fielding," he called, "that boy Lowry's cutting capers on the forecastle. Let him jump up to the masthead as quick as he likes and learn manners there until supper time." All the seamen who had seen action were of their captain's opinion about gunfire. Nothing would bring another man of war over the horizon quicker than the distant thunder of a cannonade, even one so far away that it sounded like swallows in a chimney. And if possible, those aloft looked out with even greater zeal. So great a zeal, indeed, that a little before Jack's guests arrived for dinner, a message came below. From the main masthead, Jevons, a reliable man, had almost certainly sighted, if not a sail, then something very like it far to leeward. 2 points on the starboard bow, now dipping below the horizon, now nicking it again. This wasn't confirmed either from the fore or the mizzen, but then they were both considerably lower. "I believe there's just time to have a look," said Jack. "Stephen, be so kind as to entertain Blythe and Dick Richardson for a moment if they should come before I'm down." He tossed his coat onto a chair, seized his telescope and made for the door. Opening it, he found himself face to face with his guests. "Forgive me for 2 or 3 minutes, gentlemen," he said. "I'm just going aloft to see what I can make of this sail." "May I come too, sir?" asked Richardson. "Of course," said Jack. On deck, he hailed the lookout, telling him to move down out of the way, and while Richardson was shedding coat and waistcoat, he sprang into the shrouds and so up and up into the top, where the lookout had just arrived. "Oh,
Lord, sir, he said, how I hope I was right.
I hope so too, Chevens, said Jack.
He grasped the windward topmast shrouds while Richardson took those to the lee. And very soon they were at the masthead, the lookout post, standing on the cross trees and breathing a little quicker in the heat. And with one arm round the t'gallant mast, Jack swept an arc of the western horizon.
"Wheel away, Jevons," he called.
"Between 1 and 2 points on the bow, Your Honour,"
came the anxious reply. "It came and went like." He looked again, hard and steady. Sea, sea, and nothing more.
"What do you make of it, Dick?" he asked, passing the glass.
"Nothing, sir. No, nothing, I'm afraid," said Richardson at last, most reluctantly.
The Diane was one of the comparatively few ships that had royal masts. They allowed her to set true royals and even skysails above them on occasion. And these royal masts rose above the t'gallant, being secured by jack crosstrees high above, by a pair of shrouds, and, of course, by stays. But the Diane's main royal mast wasn't 6 inches across at the thickest, while the t'gallant itself wasn't much more, its shrouds and stays correspondingly frail. And Captain Aubrey weighed at least 17 stone.
"Oh, sir," cried Richardson, seeing him grasp the t'gallant shrouds with his powerful hand, "I'll jump up in no time at all. Please, may I have the glass?"
"Nonsense," said Jack.
"Sir, with respect, I'm only just 9 stone.
"Bah," said Jack, already clear of the cross trees. "Keep still. You'll ring the mast leaping about like a goddamn baboon."
Richardson said, "Oh, sir," again, then fairly clasped his hands in prayer as he saw Jack's massive form mount the meagre spider's web. The leverage of that revered bulk on so great a length of slender mast, with the ship rolling 15 degrees and pitching somewhere near 5, hardly bore thinking about. And he'd put his hand on the t'gallant cap for signs of movement or yielding when Jack, firmly perched up there, one arm hooked into the royal shrouds, called,
"I have them, by God, I have them! But only proas. 3 sail of proas standing south."
They reached the deck by the backstays, gravity lending them wings, or the equivalent.
"I'm very sorry to have kept you waiting, Mr. Blythe," said Jack to the purser, "and I'm very sorry not to bring you good news." "They were only proas."
"Only proas? Ruined his Sabbath Nankeens to see them, and delayed the fucking poached eggs in red wine till they was fucking grape-shotted horse piss,"
said Killick to his mate, his harsh, shrewish voice perfectly audible in the cabin.
"As far as I can make out," continued Jack, "they were on a bowline, so perhaps our courses may converge."
Converge they did, and with surprising rapidity. At pudding time, the word came down that they were hull up from the deck. And when the dinner party moved up to drink their coffee under the awning in the open air, the proas, 3 of them, were within gunshot. Remarkably large craft, and with their outriggers, remarkably stiff and fast, sailing on a wind. They were crammed with men.
"There's not much doubt of their calling," observed Mr. Blythe, "or they lack's the Jolly Roger."
"Perhaps their presence explains the emptiness of these waters," said Stephen.
"Perhaps they've swept the ocean clean."
"Like pike in a stew," said Richardson.
In his glass, Jack could see their chief, a little wiry man with a green turban, high in the rigging and staring at the Diane under a shading hand. He saw him shake his turbaned head, and a minute later the proas hauled their winds, skimming away at 13 or even 14 knots on the moderate breeze. Divisions, articles, plumb duff, proas had marked that Sunday. But there was still another event to set the day apart. As the sun went down into the sea, a great red-golden ball, so into the eastern sky there rose the moon, a great golden-yellow ball, as full as a moon could be. It was not a rare phenomenon, indeed it was a very usual one. Yet this time, for purity of sky, the particular degree of humidity, and no doubt a host of less obvious, rarely coinciding factors, it had an extraordinary perfection. And all hands, even the ship's boys and the loquacious, thick-skinned old buggers, watched it in silence. All hands, including the Diane's captain and most of his officers, held it to be an omen. But there was no agreement about what it foretold until the next day when they sailed westward, passing the false Fortunas within a quarter of a mile. There was no flag, no flag whatsoever. But on the conspicuous rock, at the very top of its white streak, sat a large black bird, a cormorant, with its black wings open and dangling. It was in vain that Stephen asserted that a cormorant's presence was perfectly natural. They were usual in the southern parts of Asia. The Chinese had tamed them these many ages past. Everyone knew, from that moment on, that there was no chance of a meeting at this rendezvous. And although they looked out most dutifully that night and the next day, no one was much surprised when their eastward passage, their last, proved as fruitless as the first. Jack sailed along the chosen parallel until the end of the chosen time, for conscience sake, and then, sad at heart, he gave the order to steer southwest, following the course he and the master, working throughout the afternoon on all the available charts, all Dalrymple's and Muffet's notes and observations, had plotted as the best for Java. Sad at heart and angry too, or rather deeply vexed. He and his clerk had been making their usual readings of temperature, salinity and so on for Humboldt before sunset. He had all his tubes, pots and instruments by his open book in the cabin. But before recording the figures, he'd retired to the quarter gallery, his privy. Sitting there, he heard a crash and a confused tumbling, and when he came out, he found that Stephen had fallen off the chair from which he was trying to catch a spider under the skylight, and had not only flung seawater all over his records, but had broken an improbable number of instruments. Hygrometers, seven different kinds of thermometer, Crompton's device for measuring specific gravity, practically everything made of glass. He had also contrived to shatter the hanging barometer and tear down a sword rack, all this in a very moderate sea. By the time the cabin was in order, darkness was at hand, and after quarters Jack climbed into the main top to watch the rising of the moon. But for once the eastern sky was barred, promising rain by night, and he sat there on the folded stunsails, feeling tired and discouraged. It had been a distinct effort heaving himself aloft, and he'd felt his weight. Going much higher on Sunday, he hadn't been aware of it at all. "Is this age?" he wondered. "God help us, what a prospect!" For a while he leant back against the sailcloth, watching the stars right overhead and the truck of the mainmast weaving among them. Without giving it any conscious attention, he also heard the quiet, steady working of the ship. The occasional orders, the mustering of the watch. Richardson had taken over. Warren would have the middle, and Elliot the morning watch. He found that he must have dropped off, for two bells woke him. "This shall never do," he said, stretching and looking at the sky. The moon was well up now, slightly out of shape and veiled by low cloud. The wind was much the same, but it was likely to bring up showers and thick weather. In the cabin, he found that Stephen had retired to the lower deck. So he called for toasted cheese and a long, heavily lemoned glass of grog, wrote a note in which Captain Aubrey presented his compliments to Mr. Fox and had the honour of informing His Excellency that his ship was now heading for Java, that, wind and weather permitting, she might reach Batavia on Friday, and that it might be thought proper for the mission's servants to begin packing tomorrow, as it wasn't contemplated that the Diane should make any prolonged stay in harbour. Sent it round by the duty midshipman and turned in early. His cot moved with the ship's easy roll and lift, and the few other hanging objects moved with it, their rhythmic sway just visible by the light of the small dark lantern at his side. He felt sleep coming, and as he turned on his side to welcome it, the gleam of the epaulette on his best coat caught his eye. How he'd longed for it through all the time he'd been struck off the Navy list. Once in those days he'd dreamt he saw it, and the waking had been indescribably painful. But now, there it was, in fact, solid, tangible. A deep happiness flooded through his heart, and he went to sleep smiling. He woke again to the distant cry of, "Do you hear the news?" The traditional facetiousness at 4 o'clock in the morning to tell the watch below that they must relieve the watch on deck. Then the voices closer at hand of Warren saying to Elliot, "Here you have her," together with course and orders, and then Elliot's formal repetition. And there was the voice of the ship, which told him that the breeze was steady. Nothing could be more regular. And out of nothing came the thought that, of course, Stephen would have learned acquaintances in Batavia. The instruments could all be replaced or made by skillful artisans. The chain of careful measurements carried halfway round the world would be broken only by a day or two, three at the most. A little before two bells, the idlers were called, and at two bells itself, by pale moonlight, the ritual cleaning of the decks began. Although they'd been thoroughly washed by showers throughout the middle watch, the grinding of holy stones that reverberated through the ship didn't wake Jack Aubrey, but the first rasping shudder as the keel scraped on rock brought him out of his cot wholly alive and present. The moment he was upright, the Diane struck with shocking force and flung him down. Even so, he was on deck before the messenger had reached the companion ladder. "Man the braces!" he shouted in a voice loud enough to carry over the all-pervading sound of the ship crashing on over the reef. "Lay all flat aback! Bear a hand, cheerly there, forward!" The way was coming off the Diane, and now a last heave of the sea set her high on an unseen rock. Motionless. The men of the watch below were pouring up in the half-light. Almost all the officers were already there. Jack sent a carpenter's mate to sound the well. "Mr. Fielding," he said, "let's get the doctor's skiff over the side." 2 foot, sir, and rising moderate," said the carpenter himself. "I went down directly." "Thank you, Mr. Hadley," said Jack, and the news spread along the deck. "Only 2 foot and rising moderate." A few more urgent measures, and now Richardson was calling from the skiff. 3 fathom under her stern, sir. 2.5 amidships, 2 under her forefoot. No bottom with this line, a cable's length ahead." "Clew up all," said Jack. "Stand by to let go the best bower." The half-light was changing. The sun sent a brilliance into the low eastern cloud and then showed above the horizon. 4 bells struck. Jack walked forward to see the best bower dropped, a precaution in the event of a very violent squall, but taken chiefly by way of general comfort. Not all present were heroes. And when he walked back, it was day. A day that showed a fairly heavy but declining sea, a sky promising fair weather, and a mile to the north an island, a green-covered sloping island of no great size, perhaps 2 miles across. "What are the well, Mr. Fielding?" he asked. 2 foot 7 inches, sir, and now we may be gaining. Mr. Edwards would like to speak to you, if you may." Jack considered, looking over the side. The ship felt dead, as though she were in dry dock. She hadn't stirred, much less hammered, since that last terrible heave, and she was unnaturally high in the water. In an aside to the quartermaster and the two helmsmen, he said, "You may leave the wheel." And then he returned to his contemplation while the chain pumps whirred and flung out their stream. The water by the frigate's side confirmed his instinctive guess. She'd struck at the last moment of springtide high water. The ebb was already moving fast. Turning, he saw Killick mutely holding up a watch coat, and beyond him, Stephen and Edwards. "Thank you, Killick," he said, putting it on. "Good morning, Doctor. Mr. Edwards, good morning to you."
"Good morning, sir," said Edwards. "His Excellency desires his compliments, and can he or any of the mission be of service?"
"He's very good. For the moment, nothing but keeping those people out of the way," nodding towards a group of servants huddled in the waist. "But no doubt he'd like to hear of the position. Pray join us, Doctor. This is for your ear, too. We've struck an unknown, uncharted reef at high water. We are now aground. I cannot yet tell what damage the ship has suffered, but she's in no immediate danger. There's a strong likelihood that by lightening her, we may float her off the reef at the next high tide. It may then be possible to make her seaworthy enough to take us to Batavia to be docked. In any event, we are about to lower down the boats, and it would be as well if Mr. Fox, with all his people and as much baggage as possible, were to go ashore under a proper guard and leave us to our task."